The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. What we're going to do tonight is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. My first book, as some of you know, which came out about 10 years ago, was called The Third Rome, Holy Russia, Tsarism, and Orthodoxy. And I published that a while ago, and it sold very well. In fact, it generated quite a bit of discussion, both positive and negative. And it even developed its own blog on Amazon, which I've actually only glanced at. And there's a lot of praise for it, and there's some, I think, legitimate constructive criticism of the book. But in the last 10 years, I've changed a bit, and like any author that's even a little bit reflective, as the years go on, you're going to either want to retract or at least modify some of your earlier ideas. Now, the book itself, I still like a lot, and I'm still quite proud of. It was deliberately written in a very trenchant and mocking style. And I do that partially because I want to appeal to the average reader, not just a specialist, because I really enjoy poking fun at the mindless conformity of academics, especially the older generation, in Russia studies, in American and British universities. But most of all, what I really wanted to poke fun at is the use of words and slogans and cliches that may carry weight in a faculty meeting, but really don't have any meaning outside of the academic society. My criticism of the academic elite, the academic world that I know intimately well, has always surrounded this idea of, really centered around the idea of their privilege and their power over young minds without any responsibility for what they say or what they do. And quite frankly, they do very little work, and they're paid on average of $80,000 a year, summers off, full job security no matter what happens through tenure, and that kind of plastic prestige that academics get. And there's no oversight in terms of their behavior, including from taxpayer-financed universities. And as you get to the bigger state universities, you get into the six figures, again, with only a few months' work, and the maximum that these people, especially the tenured, will teach is two classes a semester, and those classes are simple, usually, propaganda. It's simply the professor's views imposed on a captive audience. So the whole thing is really based on fraud and intellectual conformity. And, you know, on the one hand, there's this constant and incessant outrage of the crimes of Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich, and yet it was perfectly legitimate for mainstream authors in the Ivy League to support the Soviet system, to praise the Soviet system, to talk about the benefits and gains and progress of the Soviet system with absolutely no responsibility placed on them for their rhetoric, which, you know, simply spat on the memories of the tens of millions of Russians and Ukrainians and others, as well as, of course, Chinese and Cambodians and everything that came out of the Soviet system. And apparently this is really the distinction between the Jewish elite and their view of the Goyim. When the Goyim are killed in large numbers, it's not a big deal. When the Jews are killed, it's suddenly the end of the world. And that is an offensive concept. So that's the sort of mentality that I wanted to make fun of in the Third Rome. The point was to challenge the assumptions and cliches that do not themselves get argued for in academia. The assumption is that liberal democracy is not only the best form of government, but it is the only form of government. And, of course, their supreme mystification to completely separate the activities of Republican or Democratic governments from the actions of the elite in society, economic or whatever. So, first of all, let me lay out what I accept about the book, The Third Rome. Number one, I accept the idea, one of the bases of that book is that monarchy and serfdom, and the way it developed in Russia, was not the fault of Russia itself as an entity. It was something that was imposed on Russia through her geographic position. Her geographic position is highly exposed from all angles, and Russia, from her infancy, in Moscow, period, I should say, was surrounded by extremely powerful enemies. She had just shaken off the Mongol yoke, 200 years of colonialism, and then had to deal with the Swedes, the Teutonic Knights, Livonian Knights, the Lithuanians, the Poles, and of course the Turks, the Crimean Tartars, and all the remnants of the Tartar clans, who over the centuries took, at a low estimate, of several hundred thousand Slavic slaves, selling them on the slave mart, with a great, especially on the Black Sea, with tremendous Jewish involvement. The fact is that the Vatican, the Genoese trading oligarchy, the Jewish elite in the Black Sea and elsewhere were very, very closely connected to the Mongol Empire, specifically in issues of trade. And one of the things that the Mongols did from their point of view was that they secured the trade routes within the Black Sea or to the Black Sea region and the extreme eastern Mediterranean. And they created a level of stability and turned out to be fairly talented traders themselves. So that plus the climate, the very difficult, swampy and salty wooded world of central Russia with a very short growing season and very poor soil is one of the things, one of the many things that created what will eventually become serfdom. This need to keep labor tied to the land and this need that has a lot to do with the fact that you could work and work and work and not nearly produce as much as you could in places like the Po Valley in North Italy or the black soil region of Ukraine and that kind of thing. So that's the main issue here, that these institutions weren't dreamt up by somebody. The institutions of monarchy and serfdom and the kind of, you know, general centralization in Moscow and later St. Petersburg, these were things that were largely forced on Russia, and therefore these aren't moral questions. So that was the main point, and is something, of course, that I still hold to. Number two, I hold to the fact that both monarchy and serfdom were not nearly as horrible as both the modern English-speaking academic and the Bolsheviks tried to make it out to be. Partially because it was a necessary institution, partially because peasants were always organized in the commune. Peasants had a great degree, even during serfdom, had some degree of political democracy within the communal structure. The communal structure under serfdom helped build Moscow and then later St. Petersburg into a major, not only a great power, but a major grain exporter. So this is the main issue. Now, there were always abuses in serfdom, and in the 18th century, early 19th century, many elements of serfdom, especially in southern Russia, took on the form of real chattel slavery. But that was the exception. However you want to slice it, though, serfdom is a moral problem. Again, it's something that was imposed on the country given her intensely difficult circumstances. But as the centuries went on and as Russia developed into a world power, it simply should have been abolished, and of course was abolished in 1861. And point number three, that Tsar Nicholas I was not necessarily a bad individual, because he did want to eliminate serfdom and eliminated the tight control over the state peasantry. And the peasants had been divided up, the peasants under private owners, peasants under state control, peasants under crown control or the royal family. So really at any given time, only about 20-25% of the peasants were under private owners, maybe a little higher than that. The remainder were largely in free communes under the state. And even in the 1840s, Nicholas I, freed those slaves directly under his control personally, and under the state. The crown and the state are two different things. But what I want to make clear from the book, The Third Rome, is that there is a huge distinction, and it's not dealt with enough, between the crown, the czar, his close advisors, on the one hand, and the bureaucracy, military services, on the other hand. They were two very different centers of power. They were connected, but in many ways unrelated. The bureaucracy functioned whether or not the czar cared about it. The bureaucracy functioned whether or not there was a czar at all. The bureaucracy functioned whether or not the czar was strong or weak. And a lot of the problems with the lack of responsiveness, really from any government, is not so much in terms of the monarchy, but rather in terms of the bureaucracy, which grew slowly but surely over a long period of time, and again, largely as a reaction from things that happened outside of the empire. But the economy did very, very well in the second half of the 19th century. It's something that I spent a lot of time laying out in that book. The fact that Russian labor legislation was fairly progressive for the time, I also laid out in great detail. These are things that even the enemies of monarchy have to understand. But that's the problem. Those are the things that I basically continue to accept about Russia. That is to say, the great Russian population, the East Russian population centered in Moscow and later on St. Petersburg. There were a lot of problems with the monarchy, but those problems had to do A, with the bureaucracy, and B, with the development of empire. The empire is a problem. The empires are always a moral problem because they struggle to legitimate themselves. Empire, by definition, is a denial of national and ethnic sovereignty. And yet in the Russian case, you still had, especially after the great reforms, you had tremendous local responsiveness from the zemstvo system, which was fully elective, the peasant commune, which was fully elective, and other intermediate institutions, including the church, that, contrary to public belief, was very active. They were active in moral improvement societies. They were active in temperance societies. The monasteries, especially when they had more property, were the only sources of public poor relief. And the major monasteries had thousands of people sort of on the dole who were suffering. So these are positive things. I mean, there were schools usually connected to monasteries and larger parishes. You know, there was a lot of local things happening that scholarship in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was not taking seriously. And what these people generally were doing is, whether they meant it or not, justifying the later Soviet system. So all of that comprise more or less the basic concept of the book. There's no reason to believe, given the specific Russian circumstances, that liberal democracy would have ruled the country any better than monarchy. And those people who were the apostles of liberal democracy and republicanism were the upper classes and the wealthy who wanted to use the state for their own purposes. And that's been the case in every republican system that has ever developed. It has developed because of the need and the demand for big money, trade, banking, to rule the state without being responsible for their actions. So I look to an economic establishment in the West that used politicians as frontmen, who took the responsibility for the errors and the greed of the economic establishment, the banking establishment. And yet these are the same people, through their foundations, that finance academic research. So for all the academic posturing about equality and liberalism, they are very eager to take grant money from the major foundations to promote the elitist democratic idea. So all of this stuff ended up being connected, and that wasn't necessarily my purpose from the very beginning. My purpose from the very beginning was simply to ask difficult and inconvenient questions, such as, why was it that the December's revolt that you so romanticized was overwhelmingly wealthy, privileged young men? Could it have something to do with the fact that they wanted to take over government and use it for their own purposes? Or were they simple philanthropists without any agenda? Because that latter is what they wanted us to believe. And I think these days things have changed, and that there are some more balanced approaches to these things, especially the issue of the upper aristocracy. So that's the first part of my presentation. I just want to lay out in detail what I thought I was doing when I was writing that book. The things, the dominant theses of that book that I still hold to. But within that basic intellectual unity, I've developed some things, not so much retracting any of that, but rather modifying that. And the modifications have to do, well, there's a lot of issues here. But really the big one has to do with the difference between Russia or Moscow as a nation and Russia, Moscow, Petersburg as an empire. Those are two different things. They're based on two very different moral concepts. Now, I said in the book, you know, that I wanted, Russian Empire was very different from, say, the Empire of Great Britain. The Russian Empire developed largely because the state needed to control border areas from which the Russian state had to deal with slave raids and attacks for many centuries at the cost of hundreds of thousands of lives at a minimum. So I made the argument that the big difference between the Russian Empire and the British Empire was that the former was defensive, the latter was mercantile and based on the profit motive. For the most part, territories within the Russian Empire, with the significant exception of Ukraine, largely ruled themselves and individually swore fealty to the crown, whether it be Moscow or St. Petersburg. Ukraine, of course, was a different story. And later on, you know, after I wrote that book, I got heavily involved in Ukrainian politics, Ukrainian history, Ukrainian aesthetics, and the specific witness of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. And because of that, I began slowly to modify my earlier positions on the Russian Empire. Now, what I've just laid out are things that more or less I still accept as historical ideas. And increasingly, there are some academics out there that, of course, without giving me any credit, are following my lead in this respect. And I know for a fact that there are a lot of academics out there who read this book, partially because of my reputation for sarcasm in writing and the ability to really hit the academic establishment where it hurts, and that most of all is in its conformity, its slavishness, its complete obsession with self-interest and their own self-promotion. And all of this done behind a phony smokescreen of liberalism. And I've said, you know, many times before that when I was in grad school and I began work on those theses that I just laid out a few minutes ago, I was in, you know, faculty meetings are secret. At least in the big state universities, faculty meetings are secret. Students can't know what happens in them. And so you have all these people who in the classroom are talking about, you know, civil rights and transparency, but when they run their academic departments are total authoritarians. And in these secret meetings, I was secretly denounced, very much Soviet style. And many people tried to get rid of me, tried to hurt me, tried to make sure that I couldn't function academically. And, but you know, I was a good student. My grades were good. I was a good teacher. So it wasn't really a problem. They couldn't do much about it. But when I found out about it later on, it just shows, this is at the University of Nebraska, Department of Political Science in the late 90s, you know, these people who spouted human rights and all this claptrap in the classroom, when it came to their own self-interest and their own academic work, functioned according to tenure, no responsibility, secret meetings, secret denunciations, phony accusations, and anything they could to get rid of those like me who were inconvenient. So you have to understand, I mean, to a great extent, this is the context for me writing this thing. And I simply applied a lot of those insights as to the deceitful nature of this human rights rhetoric and what it really means in practice. And how ultimately people like Pobedonostiev and the later 19th century czars were absolutely correct about who these revolutionaries were, what they were, and what they really believed. They simply lied when they ran for office, claiming to believe in private property when they did not, claiming to believe in free elections when they did not, even dressing up their rhetoric in Christian language when they didn't believe any of it, or in fact hated it. The whole thing is based on a lie, and there are close connections between the Russian revolutionary movement, the bankers that financed it, and the same bankers who finance academic research through the Rockefeller Foundation, through the Carnegie Institute, through corporate front groups, many of whom do derive from the London-based Rothschild clan. So when we come back, we're going to take a break now, and I'm going to make 9 general points as to concepts within the book that I have since retracted or at least modified. And so at the very least, I could set the record straight. So we'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're talking about my first book, written 10 years ago, The Third Rome. And I'm kind of restating its general thesis and what I continue to affirm in that book. It was not meant to be an academic book. It was not meant to be a book for college professors. It was meant to be a book for students and younger people interested in history. So in the first part of this talk, I restated a lot of what I continue to maintain and hold about that book and the ideas in it. And in the second part, I want to modify some of the basic conceptions I have of the Russian Empire and the Russian monarchy in that period of time. That is to say, up until 1918. The first problem I have with the book now, 10 years later, is that I followed a much later Russian scheme of history that begins with Kievan Rus, and after the Mongols goes to Vladimir, and then from Vladimir to Moscow. I no longer accept that particular scheme of history, and over the years I've come to accept what has, you know, for lack of a better term, been called the Ukrainian understanding, or in some cases, the Lithuanian understanding of Russian history. And the argument is that from the conversion of St. Vladimir in 988, to the Mongol invasion, Kievan Rus, of course, was a thriving, fairly wealthy, Orthodox state. But that tradition did not transfer to Vladimir and Moscow. In fact, Vladimir and Moscow were foreign to the tradition of Kievan Rus. That mentality went to the equally large and powerful Galician-Volhynian kingdom on the one hand, the Lithuanian Empire, which we would call the Slavic or Orthodox part of the Lithuanian Empire, more or less that we would call Belarus today. They maintained the traditions of Kievan Rus, not Moscow or Vladimir. In fact, when the Vladimirites or the Suzdalites under Andrew Boglubsky attacked and sacked Kiev, they did it as foreigners. The empire, the state of Suzdal in northern forested Russia, with many mercenaries, attacked and destroyed the city of Kiev. And that was done in 1169. And this man has been canonized by the Church of Moscow. Here is a man that did to Kiev precisely what the Crusaders did to Constantinople in 1204. They slaughtered people, They burnt the city down. They destroyed churches. They stole all kinds of treasures. And this man has been canonized. Andrew or Andre. That's always strongly suggested to me that the Suzdalites viewed themselves as foreigners, as different from the Kievans, and that we are now going to forcibly appropriate the ancient heritage of Kiev and its specific Orthodox tradition. And of course, a part of that argument is that the Mongol occupation left a far greater imprint on the Russian mind, or the Muscovite mind, that is to say the eastern forested Russian mentality, rather than the steppe mentality of the south, of Ukraine. That continues, and that the military formations, government centralization, all of this comes not from Kiev, not from Novgorod, or Pskov, or Tver. It comes from the Mongol influence over Moscow. So you deal now with two schemes of history. The first says that Kiev shifted to Vladimir Suzdal and then shifted to Moscow. That was sort of the royalist concept of history, the Kuluchevskian concept of history. And then, of course, there's the Rusevsky approach, the Ukrainian or Lithuanian approach, that says that the Suzdalites and the Muscovites were foreigners. They had the same religion, more or less, but they were foreigners, and they destroyed and colonized these parts of the world, forcibly taking at least some of its tradition, when in fact the reality is the tradition of Kiev went to the empire of, or I really shouldn't call it an empire, the state of Galicia and Volhynia, and the Slavic parts of Lithuania, and that they, in an uninterrupted kind of a way, maintain the old Kievan tradition. And it's that general point of view that I've come to accept. So the general scheme of history that I imply in the Third Rome, I no longer accept. The second point is Peter and Catherine. The 18th century was very, very dark for Imperial Russia. So-called enlightened absolutism was a complete disaster. I treated Peter's illegitimate wife, Catherine the First, the German control of the bureaucracy in the middle of the 18th century, then of course, the reign of Catherine the Second, at the end of the 18th century, I treated these as legitimate Russian institutions, and they certainly are not. These are institutions imported from Sweden, and you sort of have this Northern European veil over what is somewhat of a Mongol organization. And I don't mean that as an insult. I don't mean that as a way to mock the Muscovite tradition. But I have come to believe, with people like Sergei Plokhy and many others, that the Mongols are the really the variable that helped separate Moscow from the rest of the Slavic world and created a new, essentially a new ethnic group, the sort of the Eastern Muscovite Russians, who inherited what is a very, very difficult, as I've said before, very difficult geographical and topographical position. But we need to make it clear that this era for the Orthodox Church in Russia was extremely bad. The church was purged. Monasteries were shut down in huge numbers. Monastic properties were confiscated. Priests and monks were thrown into prison. Many of them were forcibly impressed into the army. The Cossacks were destroyed and brought under the control of the crown, and their elite were bought off with land and serfs and slaves. And ultimately, their independence totally destroyed under Catherine II, with a handful of them brought in to serve the Russian state. Ukraine was plundered over and over and over again. And in the Russian wars against the Turks, it was Ukrainian land, Ukrainian money, Ukrainian supplies, and Ukrainian men and guides that guided the Muscovite armies to the Turkish strongholds. The Cossacks always bore the brunt of the fighting in this regard. Peter the Great, Catherine the First, Catherine the Second, these were not legitimate Orthodox monarchs. For the most part, they were not Orthodox people. They viewed Orthodoxy as a political tool, and yet at the same time, they were considered the head of the church. It was an extremely dark time for Orthodoxy, for Ukraine, for the Slavic world in general. This was a time of the intensification of serfdom, a tremendous increase in taxes, and it shows the violent side of the monarchy. Point number three, the Church of Ukraine, Kiev. This church had traditionally been under Constantinople, and 1620 had been renewed by the Patriarch of Jerusalem. It didn't have any connection to Moscow. It had different customs and different traditions and a different language. The Russian Church, under Tsar Alexis and Patriarch Nikon, had attempted to bribe the Patriarch of Constantinople, but they largely refused, and only when the Russian government promise of peace to the Turks then authorized the Patriarch of Constantinople to sell the Ukrainian church to Moscow, which they did. I believe it was for 200 sable skins and 40 gold pieces. I could be wrong about that. But the church was bought. And with a large bribe to Constantinople. Then, of course, immediately after this, the Turks were then attacked. So in no way does the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine have any rights whatsoever. It is a fraudulent and non-canonical institution. Very soon after this, the Russian Patriarch will be suppressed, and the church will be led by a synod, what it was originally called a college, but then was an independent synod under the Oberprocurator, which was a bureaucratic designation for the eyes and ears in the Tsar over the bishops who sat in the Sobor. Point number four, the exploitation of Ukraine. A lot of the development in Russian economics came from the fact that through Ukraine, Russia now had a very fertile ground to grow. It essentially was living space for the Muscovite population, and it also served to control the Cossacks and to seal the border against Turkey. But a lot of Russian expansion came from the taking of grain and other foodstuffs and other goods from Ukraine and then shipping it under Russian merchants, Russian label, to Europe. So that was simple exploitation. And, you know, speaking of exploitation, you know, we talked about, and I spent a lot of time talking about the explosion of the Russian economy. And yet, I know that a lot of this investment was foreign. A lot of this investment came from France. A small amount came from Germany. And these are the people who built the Russian economy. By World War I, that had largely changed. But I want to say that it's not an accident that Russian government was heavily indebted to French investors and French bankers and then entered into a war on the side of France in World War I. A war that still, in my mind, makes absolutely no sense from anyone's point of view. So, the Ukrainian situation really is a large part of my modification of my former views on the Russian Empire. And point number five is similar in that the old believers who kind of accepted what I'm saying here as more or less normative, and the Ukrainian Independent Church, which sought to recreate its older structure under Constantinople, both were repressed by the Russian government. Much later on, of course, the Ukrainian language was banned. The Ukrainian church was no longer independent, even though the czars had promised over and over again that it would be independent and fully admitted that it was a different independent church from the Muscovite, and yet they made sure to simply appoint their people to it. And the old believers, who were the most pious and literate of the old Russian Orthodox tradition, were killed in very, very large numbers. So instead of making friends with Orthodox people, whenever an Orthodox group came into existence that the state could not control, it attacked it. And the old believers and the Ukrainians, for all of their specific problems, the fact is that, especially in the old believer case, these are the most pious and the most patriotic of the Russian people. And the Russian state had made an enemy of them instead of attempting to come to an agreement with them. The Russians could have imitated the Austrians and helped support a Ukrainian church that would have been friendly to Moscow and an ally to Moscow, or St. Petersburg, I should say, but instead sought rather to suppress it. And it's not just a matter of hindsight, because the Austrians were involved in assisting, in this case, the Uniate movement, but assisting in developing a Ukrainian identity that would be pro-Vienna rather than pro-Russia. Point number six, in the Russian church, there was no concept of subordinates, no concept of unity. To a great extent, the state did choose what bishops were to be consecrated, and the state did decide where they were going to go, and at least according to Gregory Fries's research, the state insisted that bishops be shifted between every 5 and every 7 years from see to see to see, so that they would not develop any close relationships with the population and hence become rebels against St. Petersburg. The old traditions of the Russian church that had been maintained by the old believers were stopped. Parishes could no longer control their own resources. Parishes could not elect their own priests. Monasteries could not elect their own people. The fact is that the state controlled these things for its own interests, which is not only against the canons, but just very bad politics. Point number seven, the Slavophiles, which I dealt with in that book. The Slavophiles were critics of St. Petersburg. I mean, this is why Alexei Komiakov and Kirinsky have never been canonized. It's because they vehemently opposed church structure the way it had been created by Peter, vehemently opposed the bureaucracy, and viewed a radical shift in Russia from the Middle Ages to the reign of Peter. And that's something that I do share. And I wrote this section on the Slavophiles as if the Slavophiles were in full agreement with the development of the Russian monarchy. And nothing can further be from the truth here. The Slavophiles were critics of bureaucracy, were critics of the state. They were what we would call national anarchists. I mean, they believed that a monarch should exist, but that he should not rule in a coercive sense. That should be done at the local level. They were not supporters of the bureaucratic Petersburgian system. They were critics of that system, and in their writings and in their rhetoric were largely supportive of the old believers. Even though they never actually came out and said that, their theology, the Slavophiles developed, 1840s, 1850s, was very much old believer in its content. Really, the last 2 points I've dealt with more or less already. The difference between Russia as Third Rome and Russia as a European empire. And I've written on that extensively. The Slavophiles had as one of their main points that Russia developed into a very different place to live before Peter, after Peter. Russia became a European monarchy, high taxes, endless wars, and the unenviable position of having to govern territories like Poland, like Ukraine, like the Caucasus, that cost a fortune to maintain and control. And the serfs, of course, paid for that. And, of course, finally, the distinction between the royal house and the bureaucracy. And one of the main criticisms of the Slavophiles is that this bureaucratic entity became autonomous. Russia was no longer a monarchy. In the second half of the 19th century, the monarch had highly limited powers relative to the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy controlled the day-to-day administration of the society, and it became the set of self-interested webs of power. And you see this in Gogol, in Dostoevsky. You see it throughout the 19th century Russian literature. Nobody defended the bureaucracy. They may have defended the monarchy. They may have defended the commune. But they never defended the bureaucracy. It was expensive. It was large. It was based not on public service, but on self-interest. And to a great extent, all of these problems are connected with the idea of empire. And to put it very simply, the big distinction in my mind now is between Russia as a nation centered in Moscow and based on the Orthodox faith versus Russia as an empire. And so as of now, I've developed the view that while I still maintain that the Russian royal state did a lot of positive things that it does not get credit for, it was incorrect to subordinate the other Slavic Orthodox people, and by that I mean the Old Believers, the Belarusians, and the Ukrainians, to it. And especially Ukraine, because it was large and fertile and was absolutely necessary to gain access to the Black Sea and to exploit for the sake of shipping her produce to Russia and selling it abroad, and the profits going to St. Petersburg or Moscow, not Ukraine. So she was exploited, and that's one of the ways that Russia developed economically and became one of the major grain exporters of the world. All of this, however, is based on the idea of empire. Empires are a perpetual moral problem, and they do not have moral legitimacy based on the idea that an empire, by definition, is based on the repression of ethnic cohesiveness, at least on the Russian case, not so much in the Austrian case. And so I hold to sort of Gogol's view of three equal, significant, independent, and yet distinct entities. Russia, Belarus, Ukraine. They should be independent. They should have their own patriarchates. They should have their own internal life. They should be independent, equal states, however existing in a free trade relationship among each other, based on their ethnicity, based on their Slavic race, and based on orthodoxy. When you study the Orthodox faith in detail, you realize that the mentality of Moscow, Kiev, Minsk, they're very different from each other. They're three very different groups of people. They hold to the same canonical tradition of the faith and liturgy, and yet are very, very different in how that's applied in the day-to-day world. And I don't have enough time to get into that here, but I have dealt with it in other broadcasts and in other writings of mine. And I still hold today that the Old Believer tradition is the real standard of the Russian Orthodox mind, not just in terms of liturgy and tradition, but also in the fact that it envisions Russia as a nation, not as an empire. And that's the big distinction. And ultimately, the solution to the Slavic Orthodox problem is to have an independent Ukraine, of course, an independent Ukrainian patriarchate, an independent Belarus with an independent Belarusian patriarchate, and of course the same for Russia, and the same that Russia did with Georgia in the later 19th century. And that's the solution. That was Gogol's idea, and it makes the most sense where nationalism and ethnicity become the basis of solidarity rather than monarchy. And to recognize that while the Orthodox Church is unified in its canonical tradition, and that that is absolutely central and binding on all Orthodox people, how that's manifested in the day-to-day life of different ethnicities in different states is often very different. And that makes sense because people are different and ethnicities have developed in different ways with different influences. And I've dealt with that in detail in both in my writings and in my other radio broadcasts. So I'm going to wrap this up. And what I wanted to do here is give you an idea in that book of what I continue to affirm and what I deny, or at least what I modify from that book. But when you see it in light of its purpose and its initial thesis, I hold to it in general. And yet in these areas, I have developed a little differently from what I was 10 years ago. And I'm not so much retracting things, but rather modifying them in light of other research and other authors and other things I've been exposed to over the last 10 years. So I thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.